From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the latest from Facebook's newsfeed. Russia used the social media giant to sway our presidential election, purchasing ads, creating fake groups, rolling out a stealth propaganda campaign that may have reached 100 million Americans. Now the Senate Intelligence Committee is paying attention. Special Counsel Robert Mueller, too. What we know? The tip of the iceberg, says a lawmaker. This hour On Point, the power of Facebook. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How's the social network working for you, for us these days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It's been a kind of a drip, 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 or maybe splash, splash, splash lately on Facebook. $100,000, we heard, spent on ads in the 2016 campaign. Here was Will Armias on MSNBC last week saying that may not sound like much, but it can translate into a lot of views.
Those are the kind of figures that you disclose if you want to minimize the extent of the problem. $100,000 in ad spending on Facebook can go a long, long way if it's done well, if it's targeted well. And there's been some reporting from the Daily Beast and others that suggests this may have translated to 20 million, 50 million, 100 million people in the United States seeing these posts on Facebook in their feeds.
Lawmakers now getting very interested. Last week, Virginia Senator Mark Warner, top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, told CNN's Aaron Burnett that he'd been wondering for months just how much Facebook was used by Russian trolls.
We got a preliminary answer today. I think maybe we saw the tip of the iceberg where Facebook acknowledged that they found about $100,000 of Russian-placed ads and a number of pages that they will subsequently and groups that they will take down. I think that's a good first step.
And Hillary Clinton, she's on fire about Facebook. Here she was on the Rachel Maddow show last week talking about Facebook's involvement and Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign.
We're going to make Facebook own up to everything. They're just begun to own up. They have a long way to go before they get to where they need to be, in my opinion.
Okay, lots of eyes looking at Facebook these days for all kinds of reasons. Yeah, millions, billions online, but well beyond that in the halls of power. Joining me first today from San Francisco is Mike Isaac, technology reporter for the New York Times, reports on Facebook from the San Francisco Bureau there. Mike Isaac, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we've got this $100,000 ad buy. And then we heard about, and this was ProPublica came out with this, you could buy really incendiary sort of ad targets to market to on Facebook. We'll talk with them in a second. You and your fellow reporters have been writing this week about how Facebook is, it's not just in the U.S. that it's grappling now with governments and oversight, but all over the world they're having to tailor and engineer what they offer in order to have access. Can we start there, Mike? What's the challenge Facebook faces as it goes deeper and deeper into the world, 2 billion plus and counting now users?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And here's the thing, you know, Facebook is, headquartered in Menlo Park, Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. California. You know, it's a very Western, typically over the past 12 years, had a very Western view of the world. You know, free speech and democracy are how Mark Zuckerberg has been brought up. And so, you know, as they look to add the next billion users outside of the United States and outside of even Western countries in Europe and look towards South America, Asia, and different parts of Eastern Europe, you know, Facebook has had to ask itself, what do we need to do to sort of play by the rules in these other countries and other governments where they don't espouse the same values we have here, and maybe our approach has to be a little bit different. And I think that has been controversial inside the company for some time. You know, they've had these sort of core values that they believe should apply outside of the U.S., but it seems like it's also unrealistic to have the same type of service in these other countries. So you can take a look at how they operate in, or how they considered operating in China at one point. I did a story last year on how they had this tool built internally that the Chinese government could use or at least participate in to help censor some items in the newsfeed that might be a little bit politically sensitive inside of China. So those are concessions that Facebook probably would not have made a few years ago. But as they're sort of saying, okay, how do we grow more people? How do we bring more people onto the platform? And then maybe if we can just get them connected, we can start, you know, going from there, and maybe things can sort of change from there.
You report on a new avenue that they've built in for Vietnam, for example, for Hanoi, which wanted a way to intervene more easily and quickly in what Facebook was putting up. What have they done there?
Yeah, I mean, like you know, it was similar to this idea they had in China. You know, if there's sensitive sort of topics, you know, we talk about this one man in Vietnam who had posted a poem on Facebook, and you know, it was a sort of politically sensitive thing, and the government, you know, there obviously didn't care for it. So there was an avenue in which they can prohibit that from showing on other people's feeds. And you know,
it seems so mild by American standards. This is a Vietnamese poet with one line in his poem that says, yeah. "A century has passed. We're still poor and hungry. Do you ask why?" And the Vietnamese government wants a way to get in there and, I guess, take that out.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, over here it seems relatively benign, or, you know, in a free society, we post all sorts of things on our Facebook all the time, and we don't have any worry of sort of government intervention. And so that idea that we can even come to that point in these other countries, and Facebook is willing to sort of concede that, that's pretty new. I would say that's definitely very new for the company over the past few years.
But if they want to stay on this huge growth trajectory, which brings them numbers of users, they've got to deal with those realities. You say the internet is balkanizing. It's not one system all over the world, and Facebook is having to deal with that reality.
Yeah, I mean, you know, take a look at Eastern Europe or China and Southeast Asia. All these countries have their own internet services that are popping up that are willing to play by the local rules. So in China, they have WeChat, and that's sort of dominated the entire country. And the company is willing to censor different things according to the government. So Facebook has had to realize, if we want to even have a foothold outside of our places that we're already dominant, what do we have to do to even get to that point?
They've wined and dined the Chinese. They've bent over backwards to try and get in there, but that has not succeeded so far. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg learning to speak Chinese, and you remind us a couple of years back, even asked the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, whether he might offer a Chinese name for Zuckerberg's then to be born firstborn child. I mean, this is a big honor in China. She declined, but that's really going the extra mile. But China said no thank you to Facebook.
No, yeah, they you know, the funny thing for Western internet companies, for Google, for Facebook, for Uber, for everyone, you know, China is this sort of white whale. You know, more than a billion people there, you know, untold numbers of dollars, ad dollars to be spent marketing towards Chinese. So anything that might help them get a little bit closer to getting into the country has been on Facebook's radar. Mark Zuckerberg in particular has been obsessed with it probably for the past decade or so. But, you know, everyone's had sort of varying degrees of success getting into the company and or into the country, and we haven't really seen anyone take off, at least of Western countries so far.
Meanwhile, Facebook has been under scrutiny in this country as well for the role it played in this 2016 campaign. We heard there from Senator Mark Warner, the Senate Intelligence Committee, interested now in Facebook and its work and how it works in this country. Robert Mueller asking for evidence related to that ad campaign. Robert Mueller, who's leading the Russia investigation, is Facebook cooperating? Are they sitting down before committees on Capitol Hill? Are they talking with Mueller?
Yeah, so they have publicly said that they're cooperating with Mueller's investigation. They have not said exactly what has been required of them, if there's a warrant involved, or, you know, if there are certain restrictions on what they're allowed to share. Now, Mark Warner, Senator Warner, as you were just saying, has been kind of frustrated because Facebook isn't disclosing the types of, you know, what the actual ads were that were purchased and what the groups were that were targeted to. And they're being kind of a black box here, and we don't really know the extent to which this has gone so deep inside. And part of that they might argue is because of legal restrictions. But I think part of it, too, is that they probably don't even know how far this goes. You know, a lot of this seems to be catching the company off guard at this point, and now they're kind of scrambling to say that they have things under control. But I think, honestly, this goes much deeper than we've hit so far.
And not just ad buys, but groups created on Facebook that actually resulted in rallies in this country. We had a report from Natasha Bertram from Business Insider last week. It was on MSNBC. It said a fake Russian group on Facebook with a couple hundred thousand followers shut down last week, reached out to the Texas Nationalist Movement to order an anti-immigrant, anti-Clinton rally in Texas 3 days before last fall's election.
The Facebook group actually created events that people attended, and they posted photos of themselves at these rallies. There were probably several dozen of them that showed up. It was nothing too successful, but people were, you know, rallied to go out there and protest because of this fake Russian group.
Mike Isaac covers Facebook for the New York Times. Is Facebook taking responsibility for these things, or are they saying, look, we're just a platform. People put up what they like. It's not our problem.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you said the magic word, platform. I would say in Silicon Valley history and in internet history, really, the idea of the platform and this sort of defense of internet companies has been, look, we just provide the service. We just provide this platform for you to express your ideas and views. And then the responsibility is on you, the user, to sort of abide by laws and local restrictions. And, you know, I think that argument is controversial, especially when it gets to the point of, well, has your platform been misused and used to sway the outcome of elections, or is it used to organize hate groups and sort of congregate around the country? So that's I think this is the biggest question of how much is the company and the platform responsible for what's appearing on it that we've ever really seen.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Facebook, mesh now in politics, presidential politics, geopolitics, and asking, what is Facebook's role in the world? You can join us this hour. How do you see it these days? Is Facebook good for society, good for democracy? Is it too powerful in shaping how we see the world, how the world gets at us? And were you thinking a year ago that it might be Russia buying ads to sway American votes, your vote, starting Facebook groups to pull you in? Is that all right? Mike Isaac is with us, technology reporter for the New York Times, based in San Francisco, covers Facebook from there. Mike, stand by there. With us from New York right now is Julia Angwin. She's an investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica. Wrote a piece for ProPublica last week, headlined, Facebook enabled advertisers to reach, quote, Jew haters, unquote. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Julia Angwin, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Was this a sting that you pulled on Facebook, or how would you describe your exercise here?
I mean, actually, it was very simple. Somebody sent me a tip saying, you know, you could buy an ad category called Jew haters on Facebook. I thought it was a hoax. I went online. I looked. I saw it was there. Then I thought for sure if I tried to buy an ad, it wouldn't go through. But then I bought an ad and went through. I did it two more times just to make sure. And then we wrote a story saying, hey, you know, this is weird. Is this really the kind of ad category Facebook wants to be selling? And they did pull it and a whole bunch of other ad categories afterwards.
An ad category is for advertisers who want to reach people with particular interests, right?
Yeah, the way Facebook does it, and I don't know how many people realize this, but basically everything you do on Facebook immediately becomes an ad category. So these Jew hater things, it seems, were things people had written about themselves in their profile to describe themselves. So everything you write, like I love Bon Jovi or whatever, mm-hmm. turns into an ad category.
Okay.
Also, all the behavior you do on Facebook automatically gets turned into an ad category.
Is it fair to really go after Facebook on this? I mean, if I read your story correctly, there were very few people in this category of quote, the self-described Jew haters.
2,200. Yeah, that's right.
Out of Facebook's users, that's not a lot.
No, it's not a lot of people. But Facebook helpfully suggested to us a few other categories we should buy to enhance our audience.
Such
so
as?
How to burn Jews, why Jews ruin the world, Nazi party. It turns out there were a bunch of categories like this. And then after our story ran, people went and dug around even more. The thing is that all the tech platforms offer some type of ad targeting, and many of them don't police them. But Facebook does police some, right? They didn't have Muslim hater. Like, they do have some level of control where they try to they sell themselves as having a clean, well-lighted space and no hate and this and that. And they clearly just weren't sort of policing these enough.
When you say they suggested these, they've got algorithms that somehow linked. If you're interested in this sort of creepy anti-Semitic thing, you might be interested in that one.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, their first suggestion was the Second Amendment. So I don't know if their algorithm has learned that, you know, there's some relationship between that and anti-Semitism. But, this whole process is entirely automated. You know, it doesn't appear that there's a lot of humans involved.
What do you make of this? Is this just an oversight, Julia? Or what should we take away from the fact that you figured out that some pretty ugly stuff could be, or ad categories could be targeted here?
Well, you know, this follows on work I did last year where we showed that they had some ad categories that you could block your ads from being seen by Black and Hispanics, and that, in fact, we bought a housing ad that we blocked from being viewed by Blacks and Hispanics, which, you know, lawyers told us might violate the fair housing law, which, you know, requires no discrimination in housing ads. And for credit and employment, there are similar laws. So, you know, I've been sort of following this theme, which is like, do they have any legal checks along the way, you know, to make sure that these ads aren't – they're not letting people do things that are illegal, right? The Russian ad buy is a very good example, right? They're not supposed – you know, there's not – you're not allowed to accept advertising money from foreign nationals for electioneering communications, and they did. So the question is really, what kind of checks and balances do they have, or is this just an automated system that just runs on its own until somebody catches it?
Mike, is that the allegation here, that Facebook has actually broken the law by serving as a vehicle for foreign entities buying influence in an American campaign?
Yeah, I mean, Julia's piece was super great. And I think those are the larger questions that we're sort of wrestling. I think it also sort of highlights the fact that, you know, these ads are not regulated in the United States. Radio and television ads have been long part of political discourse, and those have to sort of go through a process, you know, under election laws, just so that we know who is advertising to us and why. And we're so far behind on grasping how digital advertising even works. I think the general public doesn't really know how it works. I think I have a, you know, tenuous grasp on a lot of this stuff. So the fact that these are not actually being overseen by regulators, much less people, actual humans inside of Facebook, is significant, you know. And this, I guess, it took this kind of reckoning to get to a point where people are starting to say, well, look, you know, our algorithms really going to do all the work that we need them to do right now, or are they not to the point that they need to be? And I think there are technological problems with that. I think there's just process problems that we need to come to grips with. And I honestly think that Facebook hasn't even foreseen a lot of these things and is sort of realizing how much work it needs to do to get to a better point, I guess.
Real questions here about how much that black box should be opened up. What's free, just straight free speech here? Is Facebook a media company or just a platform? What about the weight of its role in politics in this country and well beyond, as you report, Mike Isaac? Let's go to our callers. New York, Charles is calling from New York City. Hi, Charles, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's on your mind?
So I think we're slowly opening that box you speak of, and we're understanding that apart from being a social media company, we're understanding what the ads do in everyday consumerism. Like, we're understanding the impact of politics. And so as we're slowly understanding it in America and in the Western world, in undeveloped or less developed countries, it's still an untapped market. So I was giving an example. Next month, 2 months from now, in November, it's Liberian national election. And for the first time, I have family from there, so I follow it closely. For the first time, significant amount of traffic on Facebook has to do with that election and the people talking about it, people doing ad campaigns, and it's a significant enough where it's drawn attention to it. And so you think about the ability for a foreign entity to influence an election, and I'm scared that in a country so small like that, it's quite possible that a few individuals can completely influence it, especially where, you know, there's a history of corruption and countries like that.
It's a totally global world. Charles, sitting in New York watching Facebook, headquartered next to you, Mike Isaac, thinking about an election in Liberia. I mean, you reported in your piece this week that Facebook blocked by China, can't go there. Regulators in Europe are tougher on Facebook than in the U.S. on privacy front. Africa's become a big target for Facebook, Mike.
Yeah. You know, the really sort of interesting or even funny irony about all of this, and I think Julia's piece really highlights this, is that, you know, Facebook ads, Facebook has sort of positioned itself as the premier ad platform in the world. You know, the whole reason that Facebook is so good at what they're doing is that they have, you know, troves of information on how we act on Facebook, on how we act outside of Facebook, the types of sites we're seeing. So they can build these profiles on the type of people that we are and what we're interested in, what we want to do. And that's why, you know, some of these ads are really effective in, or that's their sort of pitch. So if you buy into the idea that, you know, a little bit of Facebook advertising, you know, even bought by a foreign government, can go a long way, then, you know, this is kind of a tacit endorsement of what Facebook has been saying all along. It's just sort of them recognizing, oh my God, what have we wrought here, and how far can this go? And to the caller's point, you know, this is not just the American elections we need to start thinking about. You know, this is a global company, and this has implications far beyond just the presidential election in the United States.
I mean, Julia, how do you think about it? This is this nefarious, or is this just an effective ad platform, whether you're selling soap or a politician?
Well, I think that political communications are different. You know, the fact is that I'm not saying any politicians particularly doing this, but Facebook is a perfect platform if you wanted to lie and tell one group one thing and another group another thing. And we've never had that situation, actually. And since William Henry Harrison was president, he actually traveled around the country and said different things in different places, which is why the traveling National Press Corps grew up. They were like, oh, we got to follow these candidates around so they don't lie. Mm. Well, now we have an automated way you could lie, and these political ads disappear. They're ephemeral. The only person who sees them is the person to whom it was targeted, and they might see it for just a minute or even a few seconds, which is why, if you don't mind me doing a plug, we just launched something to monitor political ads online and collect them publicly. It's called the Political Ad Collector, and it's a little tool you can add to your web browser, and we're collecting ads right now in the German election, which is happening this Saturday, and we're going to make a public database of all the ads so everyone can see what are politicians saying on Facebook, and we're going to do it in the U.S. as well.
I want to bring in Scott Galloway, also in New York City, professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, teaches brand strategy, digital marketing, but he's author of a new book coming out next month, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Scott Galloway, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we've got some very particular instances of Facebook being used in a political way here, and a sense that in this country and globally, it's bringing a new kind of capacity for tailoring and targeting political messages from inside a country, from outside a country. Is this disturbing? Is this just the way of the world in an internet age? It's inevitable. This is the way it's going to go. How do you look at it, Scott?
Yeah, I think disturbing is a good word. I mean, when you have what is arguably the most successful company of the last decade weaponized to undermine our democracy, you know, it rattles our cages, and it should.
What do you mean by weaponized to undermine democracy?
Well, we have a foreign adversarial entities using a credit card and the Facebook platform to spread fake news and create chaos within our electoral process. So, I mean, this, you know, there was a lot of news about the white supremacists at UVA, and my view that fake news and the ability to weaponize these platforms that now reach 2 billion people globally, that's a much greater threat, I think, than a very small group of people who don hoods every once in a while.
Scott Galloway, I wish you'd go deeper. When you put this word weaponize out there, in defining what you mean by that. I mean, we talk about free speech, and, you know, it's written right into our Constitution. So it's a kind of speech. What makes it a weapon?
Well, sure, we have the First Amendment, but that's for citizens. We also have laws that say foreign entities aren't allowed to fund political ads. And the New York Times reporter accurately brought up that when you run an ad on television, TV stations keep very accurate logs of those ads, who's buying them, and then make those logs public. And in this instance, well after the fact, we find that media and ads put on Facebook, which lends itself credibility, which has incredible targeting tools, perhaps could go after swing voters, was spreading very divisive news. And we have a company that's become the fourth most valuable company in the world trying to say they're a platform, which in my mind is tantamount to McDonald's claiming they're not a fast food restaurant, they're a fast food platform in defense of 80% fake beef. It's just, in my view, it's just totally unacceptable.
So define your terms there. What makes Facebook, I guess, in your view, then, a media company, not a media platform?
You create content. You sell advertising against it. You make a great deal of money at exceptionally high margins. Boom, congratulations, you're a media company. And with those types of gross margins, profitability and impact and position in society come a certain level of responsibility.
If we treated Facebook as a media company instead of a platform, what would that mean in policy terms, Scott?
It would mean that they would be held accountable for ensuring there's a certain level of veracity or credibility around the content that is put on their platform to make money off of. Their response is, we can't be the arbiters of truth. In my view, is what you can sure as hell try. When I walk through security at an airport, they're not trying to be an arbiter of whether I'm a good person. They're trying to ensure that I'm not planning to do something awful. And they should have safeguards in check to ensure the same of people running ads on their platform. And they fail to do it.
Mike Isaac, do they fail to look out for veracity? Is that the case? And what about this characterization as a media company? Does Facebook fight that?
Yeah, these are really great points coming up. I think Facebook is a few things. One, I think they're terrified of just the idea of being regulated in general, and that's why they so frequently position themselves as a technology company and point to the other things they're working on, like virtual reality and mm-hmm. Drones that deliver internet to different parts of the world. But you know, as we were saying, the newsfeed is one of the most powerful, you know, mechanisms of delivering information across the world right now. You know, media companies like my own and others mm-hmm. Work with Facebook and rely on Facebook to get our information out there. So they downplay the amount of power and influence that they have here, and that really, you know, they want to do that. It's a very conscious effort because they look to places like the EU, where they're much tougher on internet companies over there, and they're hoping that sort of positioning isn't coming to the United States. But over the past, I would say, a few months, and especially since the election, the tide has really turned on sentiment against some of these companies, and now I think that's Facebook's biggest worry.
Julia, what could that mean in policy terms for Facebook and how its operations, the way it's run, might change or be required to change?
I mean, yeah, right now, you know, Facebook has tried to set up like a global policy. So we actually got some leaked slides that we published back earlier in the summer of the rules they have for censorship online on their platform. And they distribute them to all these workers. And they've tried really hard to make like a global value system. It doesn't really fit with any legal system that we know of.
What kind of thing do they censor then?
So they've decided to make their own definition of hate speech, and which is what we focused on. They do so censor other things like child porn and graphic violence, which I think many people would probably agree on those standards. But hate speech is a very particular and political thing because it can be political expression as well. And so they came up with seven types of categories of attacks that they call hate speech, which are things like call for violence and slurs, cursing. And then they just chose seven different types of people that are protected from that type of speech.
And then they monitor for that globally?
Yeah, they do. And they delete things that don't fit with their standards on that. But the problem is we don't all share the same values globally.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Facebook, enmeshed now in politics, presidential politics, geopolitics, and asking what is Facebook's role in the world these days. Lots of countries looking at that, the U.S. looking at that after the 2016 election and what's come out about ad buys by Russian players on Facebook. You can join us this hour. Do you think Facebook's too powerful in shaping how we see the world, how the world gets at us? Does Facebook still charm you? What is Facebook becoming? Mike Isaac is here. He's a San Francisco technology reporter for the New York Times, just up the road from Facebook's headquarters out that way. Julia Angwin is here, investigative reporter for ProPublica. She went after Facebook after a tip on hate speech ad categories that you could buy to get at those Facebook users. And Facebook changed at least a little bit of their policy in the aftermath of that. Scott Galloway is with us. His new book is The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, joining us from New York. Tahir is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Tahir, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How's it going? Yeah, I wanted to, you know, kind of look at things from a social science standpoint. You know, with marketing and advertising, you know, being at an ultimate high, especially seeing as, you know, we're consuming the media at a very fast rate. You know, I think it's needless to say that, you know, our consumption of these products in these ads are at an ultimate high. So it puts us at a position where, you know, we're kind of becoming numb to some of these influences and these radical approaches that political people are taking in their strive to be elected.
But we've had you know, fiery political speech in this country all the way since pamphlets in the revolutionary era. What are we getting numb to that bothers you here, Tahir?
Well, I mean, I use a good example. I look at it as like, it's like when you go to Walmart, right? You know, Walmart is, when you go to the store, the bare necessities that people, like buy is, you know, like bread, eggs, milk, and where is it conveniently located? You know, in the back of the store, you know, and that's because by the time you get to the end of the store, you know, you've looked at so many labels, so many ads that, you know, you probably end up leaving Walmart with a lot of things that you didn't necessarily go in the store for, you know, and that's kind of the perception that, you know, a lot of these marketing campaigns and take nowadays because, you know, people are getting on Facebook, people are getting on Twitter, you know, people are getting on these forums at a very high rate. So, you know, just when they're scrolling, looking for their friends and liking photos and you know, putting heart emojis by things, you know, it's subsequently, I feel like they're going to be receiving, you know, slander based off of where they could be located, because geotagging is definitely a thing. And SEO boosting and stuff like that. And that could fit right into the agenda of somebody that's running for a position.
You come for essentials and you get sold cupcakes maybe or a demagogue. Scott Galloway, you write about the DNA of what you call the four, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. Is it in Facebook's DNA to serve as a healthy platform for democratic discussion, debate, inquiry? Is there some fundamental problem here? You're getting down to the DNA level.
So, yeah, the brand positioning in one of your, I think it was Julia, said that they strive to be a clean, well-lit place. And that's exactly right. Its foundation or its roots in college, it's got very clean design, which was one of the key elements in it overtaking MySpace. It feels friendly. Sheryl Sandberg flies all over the world with very aspirational messages around a woman's role in the workplace. But if you really look at how the company behaves, it's sort of shareholder value at all costs. I mean, this company's behavior, not its positioning, is more kind of the spawn of Ayn Rand and Darth Vader. This is a company that is, you know, all of this comes down to one thing, and that is they could put in place the checks and controls to not eliminate but reduce a lot of the issues or problems we're discussing, but it would decrease profitability and likely the value of their shares. That's the fulcrum, that's the tension here. And thus far, Facebook has decided to avoid any sort of real regulation or cost that both NPR and the New York Times and ProPublica have decided to incur those costs to avoid these types of problems. And so far, Facebook has not been willing to incur those costs.
I mean, but you can call it a media company, but it's not a news-gathering organization like NPR or the New York Times. There is a difference, isn't there, Scott?
Well, sure, but if that's the key point, and that is news gathering. It's the term gathering, and that is Mike and Julia, when they gather news, they spend a lot of time and energy and money to ensure that there's some credibility behind the news they're gathering before they publish it. Whereas Facebook and social media platforms, where 60 to 80% of Americans now get their news, is not offering the same level of diligence and commitment, and it's resulting in some very negative outcomes.
We're getting some skeptical pushback here. D writes us online about the $100,000 ad buy that apparently came out of Russia. It says clearly that $100K was huge in ad revenues from that $9.3 billion they made in 2016. D's very skeptical. Doesn't Chelsea Clinton sit on the Daily Beast board? Of course, she is a board member of the holding company for the Daily Beast, I guess. What's the plan, our listener writes? Have Facebook censor all ads, all posting critical of Hillary Clinton because somewhere it could be a lie or misleading? Maybe Facebook can have a policy in which only the approved news sources get to post and everyone else simply can't. You hear that skeptical line of response, Scott. What do you say?
Well, there's a lot in there. I would start with the basics before you even get to censorship. We have laws in this country, whether you agree with them or not, that foreign entities aren't allowed to pay for media that supports or disparages a political candidate. And those laws were violated. And a platform, I think unknowingly, I don't think anyone at Facebook would have tolerated this had they known about it. But the technology has outpaced our ability, or at least Facebook's ability, to comply with these laws. So I don't even think this is a case of censorship. It's a case of abiding by the law. The law was broken here.
Whit in Columbia, South Carolina. Whit, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I work in IT, but even prior to working in IT, when I was in school, taking tech classes when I first joined the Facebook back in 04. And I got off the Facebook in 2007 because I said, this is just going to go off the rails with the way they're collecting data and what they're going to be able to do with data. And for me, it becomes an issue of STEM education and understanding of science and technology. Because what really prompted me, I was listening and called in today because I said, why is anybody surprised that this is where we're at? I mean, you know, had people been paying attention for the past 10 years and had even a little bit, just a tiny bit of understanding about what's going on when you sign online and in a web browser, what a web browser is doing.
You mean the way it's tracking your interests and building a profile of you, Whit?
Yeah, and by the way, this is a game that everybody plays now. The Facebook and Googles of the world are the vendors of this information because they're the ones collecting it. But you go to any website now, if you're browser isn't able to run JavaScript, and all of them are, because that's how websites, they won't make them work without JavaScript nowadays, and it's tracking you. You can see that. You can turn on tools in your browser that are free. They don't read a couple of blog posts, and you'll be able to see. You can go to NPR.org. You can go to Huffington Post. You can go to The Hill.
Sure.
You can go to Fox News, and you can see all the tracking that's taking place, and you can get an idea of what's going on, but they're tracking things you're clicking on, how much time you spend on a page. I mean, it's all out there, and this is what I'm saying, is if people have been paying a little more attention, I'm not trying to shame anybody, but I do think it's a STEM issue, it's an education issue, it's getting people to care about what Silicon Valley is doing, and also I think another dimension is understanding that Silicon Valley is not a public service. The Facebook is not a public service. Google is not a public service. These are companies, so I think people need to maybe think a little bit harder about, you know, why these companies exist, kind of.
Whit, I'm really glad for your call. Call again. It's great to hear from you. And Julie, if I may, let me put that to you. I mean, the suggestion here is almost that there's something intrinsically bad with a technology that not so long ago was celebrated because it was going to bring us all kinds of information from around the world, connect us in all kinds of new ways, social network, and yes, it would be personalized. I mean, Scott Galloway looks at this and calls Facebook, you know, the spawn of Ayn Rand and Darth Vader. Is there something fundamentally wrong with this? Is it incompatible with free and clean democratic discourse?
Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the caller's issues. You know, I've been writing about the issue, what I call the issue formerly known as privacy, for a decade now. And, you know, back at the in the days that I started writing about it, it seemed like maybe the harm was going to be the creepiness, right? They were going to build these profiles and there were going to be ads following you around. And you know, even I feel like, as a particularly paranoid person who wrote a book called Dragnet Nation about relentless surveillance, I honestly do feel surprised at how far we've come. Like, I don't think I envisioned, like, undermining democracy as one of the harms. And yet, I do feel like that's a fair statement of the problem we're facing right now. If you have a platform where people can lie with impunity, our lawmakers can lie with impunity, and we have absolutely no way to know, for instance, what happened in the 2016 election, right? There's a million theories. Oh, there were secret Facebook dark posts, blah, blah, blah. We don't know because it's literally a black box. So I think that these harms are real. We need to think about how we're going to have political discourse. If we want to have it all on one private company's platform and they get to make all the rules, then we may suffer the consequences of that.
Scott, what's your suggestion here? If these are real harms and yet you've got a whole huge industry built on exactly this kind of collecting information on individuals and feeding information to them, and yet, and of course, a lot of it is a black box. Is that somehow at odds with the proper functioning of a democracy? And if it is, what the heck do we do? Here we are. We're getting pretty, you know, we're into the 21st century and not just a little bit anymore.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a difficult question. So I'll just try and answer what I would do if I were counseling Facebook around this, and I'm not. I think in any crisis, and I do think we're in the midst of an unfolding crisis, not only against Facebook, but I think public opinion or sentiment has turned against all the four, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, for various reasons. But I think Facebook, as in any crisis, there's only three things you need to remember. You have to have the top guy or gal acknowledge the problem. He or she has to be seen as leading the response, and you have to overcorrect. I think Facebook needs to assemble a group of old and new media arbiters that have a lot of respect to put in place some sort of controls and standards. And I think, quite frankly, they just need to show an incredible commitment from a resource, both economically and a willingness to perhaps choke or introduce some friction to the scale the company has enjoyed and has resulted in such massive profitability. But it's, I mean, one of two things is going to happen here. They're either going to regulate themselves or someone is going to step in and regulate them, because every piece of the onion that gets peeled back here, it just stinks more and more.
Mike Isaac, you cover it there from San Francisco. Is Facebook capable of the kind of correction that Scott Galloway is broadly describing there? Is that compatible with Facebook's business model?
Yeah, I really, Scott makes a great point, and I really liked what the caller was saying about the thing we have to remember is that these are for-profit companies and private, public companies that answer at the end of the day to Wall Street and shareholders in these sort of quarterly benchmarks as to how they're doing in profitability. And the whole way that advertising online is set up right now is, like Scott said, is to have as little friction as possible. You and I mean, Julia went out and bought an ad targeting people who hate Jews, right? You know, like, we could go and do that. So the idea of introducing more friction into the system is, you know, sort of heresy around here. They want to make it as easy as possible to be able to spend money. I think the other thing also that we need to realize is that it happens, these affect things much further beyond Facebook's borders, right? They run these systems where you can purchase ads that appear off of Facebook on websites, on other sites. Google has the exact same thing. So, you know, whatever they end up doing, whether they force it upon themselves or the government forces it upon them, it's not just inside of Facebook's walls. I think people need to realize that it goes far beyond that.
Julia, Scott says, correct thyself or be corrected. But I guess there's a third alternative where politicians would be frightened of this sway and not want to tangle with Facebook.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I'm not entirely sure that Facebook is regulatable. You know, I mean, if you think about Europe, has probably tried to be the most aggressive with Facebook. And, you know, every time they come out with some sort of, you know, investigation, like they found recently that Facebook was, you know, collecting information that it said it wasn't going to collect from the like button. And, you know, they fined them. It was like a tiny fine by Facebook standards. And then Facebook went on with their life and nothing really changed fundamentally. And so I don't know how many government, as a global operation with 2 billion people. Like, what government other than the U.S. government, which I think might have the political capital to do it, but otherwise none of these other governments have a lot of sway with Facebook. And I think U.S., you know, look, they are our political situation right now is such that there's not a lot of checks on corporate power.
Scott Galloway, what's step one you would take in that correction? What would you say to Facebook do today to begin to get on the right path?
Well, I think they just have to be seen as taking the issue very seriously and injecting some standards and criteria to ensure that. I think Julia's point is a correct one. I think it's very hard to eliminate this, but I think they could do a much better job of reducing it. And I also want to be clear, I don't think anybody at Facebook is happy with what's happened here. As a matter of fact, I think some of the people inside the organization are horrified when they found out that these things were taking place. But in terms of a prediction, you're going to see Margaret Vestager, who I would describe as the only regulator in the U.S. and Europe whose testicles have descended and is starting to put fines on these people that actually have some bite. You're going to see your first $10 billion plus fine levied against either Google or Facebook in the next 6 to 12 months. Because the last fine at $2.5 billion barely even registered. Their stock went up 2% the day it was announced because the market was glad it was in the rearview mirror and it barely was a dent.
We'll see, and we'll see soon if you're correct. Scott Galloway, author of the new book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Julia Angwin at ProPublica. Thank you so much, Julia.
Great to be here.
And Mike Isaac at the New York Times in San Francisco. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
A special note today, the On Point National Listening Tour is hitting the road again this week. On Friday, we'll be out west in Spokane, Washington. We'll talk with Spokane citizens about our changing climate, this huge wildfire season, and how the Trump administration is dealing with these challenges. Give us your questions. OnPointRadio.org. We'll be happy to take it up in Spokane. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.